Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we preview Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, with host Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Dakota. Jack, as always, it's a pleasure for me to visit with you, and welcome again back to Main Street.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, and the sun is out, the grass is turning green, North Dakota is becoming the spectacular place it is in the summer, and so I think we're all in a much better mood.
I'm glad to experience that for the first time in the state, for sure. The Why Show will air at 5 p.m. this Sunday on Prairie Public, and Jack, your guest is Michael Ignatieff, author of On Consolation, Finding Solace in Dark Times. His book uses a wide range of literary and philosophical sources to explore the human need for consolation. Jack, why the topic?
Well, first of all, Michael is a super interesting guy. He's a historian by trade. He's done political philosophy. I've read his work before this episode. And he was also the head of the Liberal Party in Canada for a few years. And so he has the theoretical experience, he has the historical experience, and he has the political experience to figure out how one offers consolation both individually and as a leader. And that's what I really was interested in. I was interested in this cross-section between what consolation is, why it's important, but also how we give it to other people. This is a topic that philosophers don't talk that much about. And my reading of the book was really, I don't know what the term is, revelatory, liberating. I'm not sure. It gave me a vocabulary to talk about something that I'd never really talked about before, which is grieving and consolation and moving past the darkness that we experience, unfortunately, all too often.
We all try to, I think, do our best during those challenging times. But he really suggests that we look at history and that we should look at history to help us, even though we're, of course, living in the present day. Interesting look backs, if you will.
Well, that's right. I mean, what is history? It's the history of humanity. And what is one of the things that all human beings have in common? The mortality of ourselves and others. Everyone who has ever lived has watched other people die. Everyone who has ever lived has grieved loss in their life, has said goodbye to a past, has made change. I don't care if you were a Neanderthal or the king of France. Everyone has this experience. And so the artists, the writers, the philosophers, these are all people who had to come to terms with it as well. And it turns out there is this grand tradition of people writing down advice about consolation and about how you deal with it. Some of that advice is good, some of that advice not so good, and some of their experiences are catastrophic. We talk, for example, about Cicero, the Roman leader, who was so bereft when he lost his daughter that he basically lost power because he couldn't take control of a failing empire. And so we could all identify with that, right? We can all identify with the sense of losing someone that is so devastating that everything else falls apart.
You mentioned the word performance, and I guess it's true that we all perform when we are asked, how are you doing? Well, I'm doing great. Well, really, I'm not, but I tell you that I am. I want to give that as part of my persona, even though I may be struggling.
Some of this is cultural. We can express different emotions in different contexts. Men have a much more narrow range of emotions they're allowed to express in public than women. But certainly, when people ask how we're doing, we often, right, on an everyday circumstance, we'd say, fine, how are you, even if we're not. And then after a tragedy, you have to have a real intimate friendship with someone to say, I'm not doing fine. I'm falling apart. I can't manage anything. I don't know what I'm going to do. I can barely shower, right? That is not, even if someone loses someone, it takes an extraordinary amount of vulnerability and trust on both sides to allow that kind of exchange.
And as we've talked about before, sometimes some of us don't have those close, intimate relationships with people that we either want to share with or potentially burden with our problems.
I think that's right. And one of the lessons of the book is that consolation is a social experience, that you can console yourself, but that tends to fail. What ends up being the most soothing is connecting with other people, is the community coming to your aid. This is why, of course, after funerals, people bring over food. It's not just that no one likes to cook for themselves when they're grieving, but also the community wants to remind you that they're there. The community wants to remind you that you're alive. The community needs to insist that life goes on and that the future is coming whether we want it to or not. And so people who don't have those relationships, it's that much harder. People who don't have a social connection, who aren't part of a community, who are loners by nature, they have a much harder time finding consolation because they're all they have. And since they're all they have and they're broken, they can't fix themselves in the way that they might otherwise be able to do.
I wondered if there were two definitions of consolation, one for the person being consoled and the other for the person helping or providing consolation.
I think that's a really important observation. Consolation can be, pardon the professor speak here, but consolation could be a noun or a verb, right? I am looking for consolation. I want to feel consolation. That's a noun. It's an experience of something that I have, something I possess. Consolation, we give someone when we console someone, that's a verb. And so we need, if I have a loss in my life, I need to feel that my grief has a place. I need to feel better, whatever that means. I need to possess this noun, this characteristic that we call consolation. But you who want to help me feel better, who want to give me things, who want to provide food or affection or a shoulder to lay my head on or something like that, you are going to actively engage with me. You are going to pursue something. This takes effort on your part. And that's an activity. That's an action. That's a verb. So I think that's a really important observation because it helps us analyze the distinction between the two, which of course is the cornerstone of philosophy.
I've used some advice I gave my kids in my own personal life, Jack, and it came from a Stanford lecturer who I listened to, who was talking about looking forward. And he said, look, parents, go home right now and write the letters NP on the toes of every one of your kids' tennis shoes or athletic shoes. No one else will see it, but they will. When they are tired, they put their hands on their knees, they look down, they'll see NP, next play. Worry about what's coming. Don't worry about what's happened, that disastrous play you just experienced. What are your thoughts about that relative to the topic?
Well, I think that that is an important part of life. NP can be next play. It can also mean no problem, right? There's another opportunity for you to advance forward. However, the philosopher Richard Paul points out that the best critical thinking that happens in high schools and universities happens after the game, that what coaches do is they get all the team members together and they watch game videos. And the game videos are often very different than what we see on TV because they show the whole field, they show what's happening in the background, and they ask, what could I have done better? What could we have done as an alternative to this play or that play? What can we learn? So on the one hand, it is very important not to get stuck in your past. On the other hand, that kind of self-reflection, that kind of looking at what has happened in the past is really important. Also, consolation doesn't mean forgetting. If I lose someone important to me, my goal is not to erase them like Sunshine. I can't remember the name of the film, but there's a film The Beautiful Sunshine of the Immaculate Mind or something like that. I'm butchering it. People will know what I'm talking about, hopefully. And Jim Carrey is in a relationship and he wants to forget the fact that he got dumped. And so he goes to this doctor who can erase things from his brain. If I lose someone important to me, I don't want to erase them from my brain. I want to remember them, but remember with pleasure and not have the memory break me or tear me or not burst into tears every time I think about it. And so on the one hand, we have to look back. We have to remember. On the other hand, we have to look back and remember in a way that gives us strength for the future. And this is the dichotomy of the human experience. We are always balancing the past and the future, and that balance is in our minds, because the only thing that actually exists is our present. And so the memory we have is going to fuel our anticipation, our goals, our purposes. And that's what it means to be a human being in time, and grieving and consolation is an essential part of that.
We're previewing The Why Show, which will air at 5 p.m. this Sunday on Prairie Public with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a professor at the University of North Dakota. He hosts as his guest Michael Ignatieff, author of On Consolation, Finding Solace in Dark Times. Jack, Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address is a major part of your discussion with the author. And I reread it, and you talk eloquently about how there were widows on both sides of the Civil War, and how Lincoln then had to decide as a leader what to do with that inaugural address. Could he console both?
The second inaugural address is one of the most important documents in American history. It's a new start, but it's a new start that has to balance blame and reconciliation. The Civil War was the response to secession, right? The Southern states wanted to leave the Union, and the country didn't want that to happen. Now, there were heroes on both sides, to steal a line from Star Wars, The Clone Wars. And I don't mean to get into sure. politics, because I'm not in favor of slavery. But if we want to live together, if we wanted to have a country that was moving forward, Lincoln couldn't say, this is your fault. This mess is all you. He had to teach forgiveness. He had to find some way to be unified. And so what the second inaugural address was ultimately saying is, I'm not going to console you. I'm not going to make you feel better about what happened. I'm going to ask you to forgive, and I'm going to ask you to move on. And surprisingly, we haven't done that as successfully as he would have liked. I mean, in one sense, we are a strong country and we've lasted another 150 years. On the other hand, the Southern semiotics, the flags, the state rights phrase, all this sort of stuff is still very much a part of our politics. And so we haven't forgiven, and we haven't moved on. We're still stuck in that division, even if what we're fighting about is really something very, very different than what we fought about 150 years ago.
In that second inaugural address, Lincoln said, both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. There are different secular versus religious responses relative to consolation, Jack.
I think that's right. And putting aside my philosophical disagreements about religious interpretations and denominations, I think, again, there is that call to the human unity, right? That sense that we do have this spiritual part in us. You may express that through religion. You may express that through literature. I just quoted Star Wars a minute ago. We all have the texts that are important to us. And silly as it may seem, the Star Wars universe is probably as important to my upbringing as my Jewish religion, because it's been ever present since I was 8 years old. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with finding consolation in a sitcom or finding consolation in a poem. And that's why Michael actually talks about a painting by El Greco. He talks about a bunch of different poems. He talks about some music. It isn't just words that we find consoling. It's art as a whole, art and philosophy taken on two sides of the same coin. And so you don't have to have religious consolation, even though that's what Lincoln chose. You can have consolation through the music that you feel. Everyone who knows a teenager knows that they find emotional power in their popular music. And the next generation doesn't understand their popular music, doesn't have that intimate connection. Why? Because there's something particularly important about the connection between the human psyche and our mental state and the music we hear when we are that age. And so when a young person is angry, they listen to music. When a young person is sad, they listen to music. When a young person is in love, they listen to music. This doesn't have to be religious. It can be artistic in any sense. And part of what art's job is to reproduce the human experience in a way that the artist can share it with other people, with a larger audience, and consolation plays a very important part of it. What's the biggest topic of any music genre, and this includes opera as well as pop music? It's romance. It's the loss of a partner. It's the terror of breaking up, of the contrast between being madly in love and then all of a sudden losing the person who's important to you. I mean, we would lose 3/4 of country music if we didn't get to talk about breakups. So all of this is present in Michael's book. Even if he doesn't mention pop music by name, he still recognizes that art is the place where we can find consolation, because art is the place that human beings try to communicate with one another by reproducing their own experience.
One other topic I want to make sure we talked about was shame. You both visit in your interview about, you know, geez, you gave it everything you had, you know, good job, you know, but really upon reflection, maybe I didn't. Maybe I didn't do everything that I possibly could have done to keep my job, to not, you know, cause this trouble in our families, et cetera, et cetera. And so I feel bad. I really didn't, upon self-reflection. And you talk about that.
It would be unfortunate if we thought of consolation only in terms of the most extremes, of the loss of a loved one, of the loss of a love in general. We have to console ourselves when we say something stupid to a stranger. We have to console ourselves when we embarrass ourselves. We have to console ourselves when we fail. One of the things about being an academic that most people don't know is that it is a life of abject rejection. Every article I submit gets rejected a couple times before I publish it. My students, as much as many of them love me, some of them hate me. Some of them resent walking into class. Education is a weird thing. People say they want it, but they're very happy when the teacher doesn't show up. Imagine you have a job where the people you work with are the happiest when you're not there. I have to console myself all the time about the mistakes I've made and the life I live. Everyone else has that same experience. And so part of what we can attend to when we talk about consolation is just our overall wellness, our mental health, and to recognize what's big and what's small, what's important, what's not important, what's normal and what's not normal. Even my dog, when he trips, he looks around to see if someone is watching, right? Because we all get embarrassed. Those are forms of consolation, and how we deal with that and how we deal with our mistakes or not trying our best or making the wrong guess or choosing the wrong team. That's all part of the same process. It's not as extreme, but it's still very, very important because, again, we're human beings, we're imperfect, and we have to contend with our past and how our past will be viewed in the future.
Towards the end of your discussion, your guest, Michael, said this. He said, "We are in such big trouble with life. We need all the help we can get. There is plenty of help to be found. We're not alone." And I think we've talked about that, Jack, a little bit. But boy, is life really that bad? Can't we take the good stuff and run with it?
We can, but if we only contend with the good stuff, then we're not living life, right? Part of what life is the experience of defeat. A few years ago, I was doing a triathlon and I had lost my dog the night before and put my dog down. And I was exhausted and I hadn't slept. And I get out about a minute and a half in the water and I have the only panic attack I've ever had in my entire life. It was terrifying and humiliating. And I had to have someone, because in these triathlons, there are people there in case someone gets in trouble, had to have someone help me back to the shore. And I gave up on the triathlon. And it took me a really long time to deal with that. But this turned out to be a very, very important part of my life. It changed the way that I thought about myself, about sports. It changed the way that I prepared for things. it isn't the case that only positive things have value. Negative things have value too. And it's not just that good things come out of the negative things. It's that now I understand what a panic attack is and I can console others if I need to. Now I understand that I have limitations and when I have to listen to my body and not. Part of what happened because I had lost my dog the night before, I wasn't listening to my body at all. I was so wrapped up in losing this family member that I didn't have the wherewithal to say, hey, Jack, maybe going swimming, you know, where you may drown may not be the best idea. And my body knew that even if my brain didn't. That is a very positive experience, even though I experienced it negatively. And I think that's part of what he was saying. The other part that he was saying when he said we're not alone is that we have this great literary tradition, this great philosophical tradition of consolation. So if you want to learn about consolation, read Cicero, read David Hume, read Abraham Lincoln, read all of these other people or see the El Greco painting or listen to music. And the best way to do this, frankly, is to read Michael's book because it's accessible, it's interesting, and it's really powerful.
My question is about his book. Is it overly abstract and academic, or is it really thought-provoking and understandable?
Well, I wouldn't say those two things are opposite, but that's just giving you a hard time.
Sure.
It is very accessible. It is written for general audiences. You do not have to have read the things he's talking about. So when he talks about the second inaugural address, he describes it and he quotes quotes, but you don't have to do any homework beforehand. It is very down to earth. It is very emotional. It is very straightforward. There's not a lot of literary flourish. He's not showing off. He's not name dropping. It really is a very direct, efficient, and clearly written book that loves the literature that he's reading. That's the thing that comes out. He really has respect for what he's talking about, and he wants to communicate with others. This, again, is where his politics comes in, because since he was a political leader, he knows how to speak to the public. He knows how to get people to listen. And that those language choices, those rhetorical choices really come through in the book. So absolutely, it is not abstract. It is not theoretical. It is very practical, and it brings the philosophy in underneath in a way that everyone can identify with, but they don't have to look, oh, this paragraph is philosophy. Oh, this paragraph is an abstract idea. Oh, I'm going to have to read this six times. That wasn't my experience of the book, and I doubt it would be our listeners either.
We check in once a month with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Jack, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
My pleasure, Craig. Happy to be here as always.
Coming up, a look at single moms as we head into Mother's Day. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Income eligibility guideline services available through North Dakota Health and Human Services Special Health Services Unit have increased based on changes in the federal poverty levels. Starting May 1st, a family of four can now earn up to $55,500 annually. Tina Feigich is SHS Claims and Eligibility Administrator, says this number is up $4,000 from last year.
Some years it was just a matter of a couple of hundred, you know, $300, $400, $500. Last year was a pretty good increase along the line, same lines as what I'm seeing this year. But typically it's around that $400 or $500 that they increase. And then obviously the larger the family, the larger the increase. So when we get to like a family of seven, we went from $77,544 last year to $84,027 this year. So they took like an $8,000 jump.
The Special Health Services Unit helps families pay for medical services for eligible children, youth, and young adults. Feigich says the increase will help balance inflation for families, allowing them access to quality health care, even with the cost of living.
I believe the increase is very important for families just because it gives them a little bit better ability to qualify for the programs. And get a little bit more assistance, a little bit more help in covering some of those medical expenses. I think, you know, every year at this time, of year, we always have an increase of families applying because the income has gone up a little bit, and they're able to qualify then without having to pay so much out of pocket before they get the assistance.
And the State Health, the State Historical Society of North Dakota is offering a free teacher workshop on German-Russian immigrants to North Dakota. The workshop will include visits to the state archives, Welk Homestead State Historic Site, and stops along the German-Russian country talking trail. State Historical Society Education and Engagement Manager Laura Ford says teachers of all grade levels are welcome. She says this is a good way to collect content and lessons for the upcoming school year.
Teachers are always looking for new information, new resources, new ways to do things, innovative ways to do things in their classroom. The best teachers, don't use the same thing over and over and over, so they're always looking for something fresh. And to be able to teach North Dakota studies in North Dakota, you just need one semester in College of North Dakota Studies to be able to teach it. And so it's important to give our teachers these additional resources so that they can better reach our students.
Participants will learn about the push and pull factors that brought people here, the cultures they brought with them, and the connections between past and modern immigration.
We're making a conscious effort to utilize our historic sites so that teachers know that those resources are out there as well, and that they can use them, that we have several avenues to use them, be it actually visiting the site, bringing their kids to it, or using a few of our programs, like a virtual tour if you're too far away, or we have a program called Ask an Expert where they do like a Zoom call with people that staff the sites and are kind of the experts on them.
I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Pew Research data show that 25% to 30% of children under 18 are living in single-parent households. The survey shows nearly 30% of single parents live in poverty compared to just 6% for married couples. This Sunday is Mother's Day, and in another episode of Practical Kindness, Brandy Malarkey explores the many ways women become single moms and the challenges they face.
There are so many stereotypes about single moms out there, and Andrea Williams of the Jeremiah Program has heard them all.
18-year-old who got pregnant when she was 16 and she had to drop out of school.
In reality, there are many paths to single motherhood. Sometimes it could be a spouse dying, or in the case of Lisa Caceres, family helping family.
Adopted my biological niece with Hidatsa. We don't actually have names for like aunt, uncle, cousins. It's only mother, father, brother, sister, son, daughter, and grandfather and grandmother. Our kinship and relationships, she is automatically already my daughter because she's my sister's daughter.
For Lisa, the choice was obvious, but that didn't make it easy.
I really had to adjust from being a full-time college student to being her caretaker and her, you know, her mother. I had a roommate, like a college roommate, to having to move to family housing and just really adjusting to all the finding daycare, from not needing any type of services to going on food stamps and daycare assistance. So navigating all that stuff. And it was one of the most stressful times of my life.
Jerry Cooper was surprised to discover she could become a single mom at any age.
I was planning to retire and actually do a lot of traveling. But my granddaughter was more important. It started out with my middle daughter having a baby, and she had a history of drug abuse, and so I ended up bringing them back home, her and the baby. And then it just started getting worse, and I eventually applied for guardianship, and I had guardianship of her for 7 or 8 years. And then I applied for the adoption, and it took about a year, and I finally got that.
Like Lisa, Jerry faced a lot of life adjustments.
Having the freedom to go out with friends or make travel plans with friends, or if I have doctor's appointments, trying to make sure, because my doctor's appointments are like an hour away, and trying to arrange my appointments so that I can drop her off at school and then make it down to my appointment and then get back up here in time for her to be done with school. That was difficult, making sure that I had someone that could back me up in case I couldn't get back up here in time.
Parenting is expensive. Jerry's on a fixed income, which makes unanticipated costs especially challenging.
They have different programs where they normally would pay the adoption fees, but because she was never in the system, I had to do the private adoption. I don't get the help. I have to rent a bigger place because it's not just me. So there's a lot of changes that happen when you go from being by yourself to having another child. Yeah, because before, you know, I had kids, I was working, so I had more income. When you get on a fixed income, you have to budget throughout the month. And of course, with children, there's always something comes up, always.
There was yet another layer of challenges for Marina Beam and her three daughters.
We were basically fleeing an abusive situation. And so finding a safe place sometimes was a thing. Where are we going to stay tonight? I have a restraining order and I don't know that he'll respect that. So maybe on those nights, yeah, homework was not going to happen. And I know deep down I knew, like, who cares? You know, as long as we're safe, that's all that matters. There's a lack of understanding of what a single mom actually goes through.
Marina and her girls were safe physically, but not from judgment.
I told the children, I might go to every other game, you know, basketball, volleyball, maybe every third game. Again, being done at 6 or 7 p.m. at night for my work, I would then show up towards like the middle of the game. And sometimes the parents, it's like, oh, nice of you to show up. So I would just shrug my shoulders or, you know, basically give the look like, if only you knew, like you have no idea what I'm going through to get here.
For Tori Queensley, the desire to create a safe space for her daughter launched her journey to sobriety.
I'm a recovering addict and I came out of addiction when I realized that I was pregnant with her.
With a lack of good role models, having supportive programs can make all the difference.
I really had absolutely no context when it came to parenting at all. Unfortunately, our family was not very close, dysfunctional to say the least. I'm sure many people can relate to that. I did not have any experience. And so when I did get pregnant, I was offered a chance to be a part of a program that WIC offers. It was like having a family nurse practitioner come into your home every so often, and they would meet with me and just discuss things about being a mom. And so I really had this kind of knowledgeable entity to be able to know what to do.
Tori wanted to be a good example for her daughter. Through the Jeremiah program, she received the help and support she needed to go back to nursing school.
I think a lot of us feel like we need to do it all on our own, and we're somehow not a good parent if we need to ask for help, or if we need a break, or, you know, just a minute to take a breath.
Andrea, like all the staff at the Jeremiah program, is passionate about fighting the poverty that many single moms face. By focusing on education, they empower women to help themselves and others.
I think our moms leave our program having developed stronger communication skills, a stronger ability to identify self-awareness of where they need support and help, and then where to find those resources in our community. And I think they realize it's okay to ask for that support. So once they leave our supportive community here, they then have hopefully developed those skills to be able to find those resources for themselves and seek out that help when they need it.
Help can come in many forms, some specialized.
I do massage therapy, and one of my clients was a rancher. So he had beef, a stack of beef that he butchered and had ready.
Some help is really simple.
Just little things. You know, my neighbors will do stuff for me, you know, surprise me with, like, Mother's Day gave me a cup with some candy that said Happy Mother's Day. They know I'm here if they need me, and I know they're there if I need them.
And sometimes some other friends who are also single moms, two or three off the top of my head, you know, and whatever's going on in my life, anything. I feel, you know, I can always turn to one of my friends who has either been in the same situation or they know how they understand how I feel. I've always felt the most comforted by my friends. The sense of sisterhood that's just, you understand, so you know what it's like and you want to support.
But one thing is certain, all help is appreciated.
People would help me with diapers, which is probably one of the most amazing things you could ever have help with. You know, being on WIC, you know, you have that kind of supplemental nutrition that you know you absolutely need to have. And I was donated like a lot of clothes. I mean, I can't even tell you like how many clothes I was donated, to the point where there was stuff that she grew out of so quickly, and I'd be so bummed out because it was the cutest stuff you've ever seen. That's really what helped me as a single parent.
Because that help, being part of a community, helps them be the kind of moms they want to be.
She looks up to me. Everything, unfortunately, that I'm doing, she is watching. No question. She just warms my heart.
It's me and her, and then the world. She's my daughter. We have these roles, but we're still in it together.
I'm Brandy Malarkey for Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Tom Russo. Lots of great music, stories, and poetry on the next Great American Folk Show. You'll hear from singer-songwriters Susie Philipson, Jack Klatt, and Melissa Chelinski. Plus, late Mott, North Dakota poet Larry Y. Woody. And ask anyone in the northwest part of North Dakota about the Teacher's Lounge, and they won't point you to a school. Hear the kismet story of the much-loved gathering spot in Fortuna. The Great American Folk Show, Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
We hear the fanfare. It's Friday. And that means it's time for Matt Olean. Matt, welcome back to Main Street. Today's movie that you plan to review, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. It first premiered at Disneyland Paris in late April and was released in the United States on May 5th. Matt, what do you think of the movie?
Well, this is a long time coming from Volume 2. So Volume 2 was 2017. So there's been a six-year gap here between what's being called the final film of the James Gunn trilogy of Guardians of the Galaxy. He's the director who's now going to go and direct DC Comics films. So this is his kind of farewell to the band of misfits we've come to know as Guardians of the Galaxy, headed by Star-Lord, Peter Quill, played by Chris Pratt. So this feels like the conclusion of things. And the film begins with Star-Lord kind of drinking too much because Gamora, played by Zoe Saldana, has left him and become kind of a different person. And you probably need to go back and see Volume 2 to kind of know what's going on with the plot. But overall, I like this better than I thought I was going to like it. What drives the story is an injury that happens to Rocket early in the movie, and they try to save Rocket through, you know, medical things and what we get, though, is Rocket's backstory of how he kind of became a Guardians of the Galaxy, how he was invented as a raccoon. And I don't want to give much away here, but the backstory is frightening. It is frightening. It tugs at the heartstrings of the audiences. It involves animal testing and evolutionary manipulation by the villain of the film, who is the High Evolutionary, played by Chakwudi Iwuji, a dastardly villain. But The real heart of the film is the Rocket backstory and how it manipulates the audience, I think in mostly a good way, to have this kind of feeling of sympathy for Rocket, who's voiced by Bradley Cooper again. And, of course, through all this, they have to try to save Rocket. They have to fight the High Evolutionary. They have to get back together, get the gang back together. Dave Bautista is back as Drax. Very funny. Karen Gillan as Nebula. I really like Pom Clementeef as Mantis, who's very good in the movie, and she kind of has this continuing comic banter with Dave Bautista as well. So again, we get the misfits, but this film is much darker than the first two. It's much darker because of the Rocket situation. You have to go see it. But overall, I like that. I thought it was a little too long. There's about three endings. A lot of Marvel films don't know when to end. There's about three different endings. Is this going to end? When's it going to end? But it grossed $114 million in its first weekend. So pretty good, but not by old Marvel standards. Things have dropped down a little bit in the Marvel universe for the box office. But overall, I thought it was good and dark.
Well reviewed. I've read it that it's been described as funny, heartwarming, and of course, action-packed. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, all three of those, I would say. You know, Chris Pratt is definitely the leader as Star-Lord. We have some good villains in this one. And if you like Guardians of the Galaxy, I think people are going to like this movie.
Best in the series, would you say?
No, I think the first one is still the best. I still love movies, Craig, where they kind of get the gang together. You know, the recruiting film, like Avengers Part 1. The recruiting of the guys and the women, the gang getting back together. I still think Guardians Part 1 is better. I do think this is better than Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, however. So I was generally pleasantly surprised because I was not expecting a ton going in. But James Gunn, he knows how to direct action films, and that's why he's going to DC now.
He's never won an Academy Award.
No,
do you
no.
think one's in his future for a film like this?
No. You're not. The directors aren't going to win Oscars for directing Marvel films. But I would like to make a couple comments on Marvel films. They really divide critics and they divide film watchers. And I've got a lot of friends who hate Marvel movies. They just think they're a big, you know, popcorn video game, etc. But I have friends who love them. I have a friend, a film friend, who thinks this is the best Marvel film ever, which is absurd. It's not. This is not the best Marvel film ever. But I try to judge films based on what they're supposed to be. And I learned that from an old British film critic named Leslie Halliwell years ago. He's long since passed away, but he had a book called The Halliwell's Film Guide. And his theory was, for what Frankenstein was in 1931 should be equal to what Citizen Kane was in 1941. They're just different movies. But for that genre, the first Frankenstein is a masterpiece. And I do think the Marvel films, there's a place in cinema for a Marvel film and a small independent film like about Leslie. Martin Scorsese's been very critical of Marvel films, I think too critical. There's critics out there that I think are biased. They shouldn't be reviewing Marvel films because they just hate them. They don't respond. I try to judge the film based on its merits. So I get both sides of this, and I think there's a place for both films in cinema's universe, Marvel films and small films. And you can't tell me that if you got to Avengers Endgame and Avengers Infinity War that people didn't feel something. There was character development for those characters. You felt something when characters died at the end of Endgame and vanished at the end of Infinity War. That's because they took time to do character development. So the films are far more than I think Scorsese thinks they are. Some are better than others, but there's a place for them.
Overall, you do recommend this film, Matt. We needed to develop for you a scale.
Okay.
We need to think about that.
All right.
Two thumbs up has been taken.
That's long taken, yeah.
But we'll think of something else. Time for trivia.
Okay.
An actor in this movie has been nominated for 3 Academy Awards but has never won.
Sylvester Stallone, who has a supporting part in the film.
That's exactly right. Congratulations there, Matt. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for PrayPublic is provided by the John and Elaine Andrist Charitable Trust, supporting the communities of Northwest North Dakota. Information at nwndcommunityfoundation.org.
On the next Radiolab,
an amazing piece of biological detective work.
Two great mysteries of nature.
Something that has tormented men of science since Aristotle.
Solved.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The liberty of a people cannot be forced beyond its intelligence, nor can it long survive the decay of public morality. So said Dakota Territorial Governor William A. Howard in 1879. Tom Ezern gives us this Plains Folk essay.
The legislature has gone home, prompting sighs of relief across the state, not least among the legislators themselves. Yes, I have been among those taking shots at them during the recent session, or rather, I would make the distinction, taking shots at some of their actions. Now, in a quieter time, taking a long view, I think we need to say what we expect of our elected representatives. Not just say, this bill is good, this bill is bad, but rather, I'm going to sound a little grandiloquent here, but it's my job. Consider the foundational question, what is a state anyway? I'm not really a state guy. I'm a regionalist. I do the Great Plains, their history, their folklore, life in general, in grassy places. Regions are defined according to physical and cultural considerations. The Great Plains, for instance, are defined as level, subhumid, grassy. States are lines on a map. A question I addressed when commissioned to write a book chapter on the borders of one prairie state, South Dakota. Looking at their historical development, I concluded that it was good to have boring borders, rectilinear, maybe even arbitrary lines. Attempts to make political borders correspond to cultural groupings have caused us no end of trouble around the world in the past two centuries. A state is not a region. It is a political entity possessing defined sovereignty, in our case defined by the United States Constitution. A state is not merely some transactional unit, however. It is up to us, within these rectangles on the open land, to define the nature of the Commonwealth by our actions and by the stories we tell. In researching the borders of Dakota Territory and of the states created from it, I found some good guidance as to the definition of a state and how to build one. I got it from Territorial Governor William A. Howard, specifically his address to the legislature on the 14th of January, 1879. I like this guy, Howard. He was a Republican before Republican was cool, that is, in Michigan in 1853. He stood up to be counted among those who declared that slavery must be contained. In 1879, Howard foresaw a state emerging from the Dakota Territory, and he asked, "What then is a state? What is a free state? What institutions should characterize a free state? What are its legitimate functions? What its duties and powers?" Howard answered his own question. "A state is the people in a given territory and their institutions." He elaborated, "A free government is simply the organized power of the good, consolidated and wielded to restrain the bad and to protect the weak from the encroachments of the strong, or, in other words, to establish justice and secure the blessings of liberty to all the people." The first duty of government, then, was to establish sturdy institutions, including ones, he said, to provide for the unfortunate. "Humanity requires this at the hands of the state," Howard intoned. "Institutions are formative and defining." At the outset, too, and forever, Howard declared, "A free government must attend to the character of its people, do all that is possible for the promotion of the intelligence and virtue of its people. The liberty of a people cannot be forced beyond its intelligence, nor can it long survive the decay of public morality." Is anyone else feeling a little uncomfortable under the rhetorical gaze of Governor Howard? He died young, probably because he was too good for a territory often victimized by grasping graft. Howard leaves us, however, a memorable metric by which historians may measure the progress of a state or adjudge the actions of their government.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Dakota Datebook is next.
BlackBerry smartphones disappeared after the iPhone came to market, but they still linger in the memories of many people.
People really, really miss their BlackBerries. They're not happy that that's not a thing anymore. And a lot of people miss that signature click.
That's Glenn Howerton, co-star of the new feature film, BlackBerry. That conversation Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 12th. Wildfires are not new to North Dakota. With a vast expanse of grass, fires can spread easily. On this date in 1900, the Washburn Leader lamented the numerous fires that swept through the western part of the state in recent months. The concern centered around the destruction of farmland and crops, but the flames also struck businesses like the Little Missouri Horse Company barns in March of 1900.
In January alone, prairie fires destroyed a considerable amount of land in both Emmons and Barnes counties. Many farmers' homes and barns burned to the ground. These disasters were so prevalent at the time that the newspaper took to advertising preventative methods to slow the spread of prairie fire. The Dickinson Press ran an article on homemade tools. The prairie fire extinguisher method consisted of a machine traditionally used to harvest grain called a header. Stripped of its platform and gearing, the header had old carpets and sacks fastened along the axle to drag along the ground. Two pipes poked with holes were connected to barrels of water to drip water onto the ground. The article claimed that the machine could extinguish more miles of fire than 20 men in the old-fashioned way of fighting fire. Another method of prevention suggested that farmers plow fire guards. Fire guards involved removing tall, dry grass and plowing a furrow that would keep a fire from spreading. In 1892, the 777 Cattle Company also had a version of the prairie fire extinguisher. This one used corrugated iron. Three or four strips of iron, 3 feet wide and 8 feet long, were put together in a way that would be flexible. Horses would pull the metal, combing dirt over the fire to smother the flames. The fire threat was high throughout North Dakota's early settlement history. Research suggests that as settlers continued to move into the area, the frequency and intensity began to decrease. Fires were now being stopped by roads and man-made waterways. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Olivia Burmeister. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
This means more to Minot than anybody alive knows in their memory.
There's something new in the Magic City, and Main Street will take you there.
Very exciting to see this economic impact in Minot.
Join Main Street next week as we go inside the brand new Trinity Hospital, which replaces the century-old medical complex in downtown Minot.
We were in a 1923 chassis trying to do modern healthcare.
In this four-part series, we'll take you inside the nearly 1 million square foot facility and ask what role the new hospital will play in recruiting doctors to the region.
These operating rooms and the technology can't be beat.
A tour of the Trinity Hospital in Minot next Tuesday through Friday on Main Street at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Central on Prairie Public and on demand at prairiepublic.org. And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for listening. Coming up on Monday, we'll visit with Maggie Takuda Hall, author of Love in the Library. It's a children's book and a true story about how her grandparents met and fell in love in a Japanese-American incarceration camp during World War II. The book is now at the center of an American discussion about censorship. And we'll hear from Minnesota author and chef Alan Virgo about foraging for food. We hope you have a wonderful weekend, and will join us again Monday on Main Street.